the consideration of the Insurance Laws Amendment Bill. But
thank you, sir. My duty today is to respond or to give a personal response on the comments that were made during the hearings on the Special Pensions Amendment Bill. We've received a number of comments. We've listened, we've pondered, we've thought about it, and we've had certain responses. Some that agree with what has been said in the House, and some where we're explaining our disagreement to some of those things. The first comment is on the qualification criteria.
Marion, I would imagine you are talking to the matrix that has been circulated to members.
Yes.
Okay, okay. Yeah, have all the members got that matrix that she's talking to? If not, can we ensure that we all do? It was on the table, yeah. There it is. Okay. Proceed, Maria.
Thank you, sir. The first comment was from APLA MVA, the PAC, the MK MVA, Azandla, Azapo, the ANC veterans from KZN, Kulumani, and EPPCM. Basically, here, most of the commentators proposed that the age be lowered to 25. Some proposed that it should be lowered to 21, and some proposed that the age qualification be removed altogether. Now, Chair, this one is a bit of a difficult one. First and foremost, I think we need to understand the criteria, that we are being consistent with the criteria. One of the criteria says you should have had 5 years involvement in the struggle prior to 2 February 1990, and during that time you could not actually contribute to a pension fund due to your involvement in the struggle. Currently, the trends are people would normally start contributing to a pension fund around the age of 25. Now, what we're saying is for you to have been in the struggle, have been committed to the struggle and involved and not being able to contribute to the pension fund for 5 years, you would have been 19 in 1985 for you to qualify. Now, we recommend that the House agrees with us that 19 is a reasonable age to actually qualify for this. Because otherwise, we do understand that if you were 17 or 16, you could have been a casual worker, just fresh from school if you were lucky, and you would not have been contributing to any pension fund. The second one is about minimum service period. Comments by both the PAC and the AZAPO that proposed the removal of the minimum service qualification criteria. We are saying, Chair, we're proposing an amendment to the criterion only of the age qualification. That is, we're moving from age 35 and age 30, but we want to keep equity with everything else in terms of the number of years. And we recommend that the House then does not accommodate this proposal because it would change what the other group was used to actually qualify for them. The third one is about political affiliation. A comment from Kulumani that stated that not all persons that contributed to the struggle did so as members of political organizations. And they were proposing that this qualification was deleted. Again, we would like to apply a consistency and equity in terms of the criteria. We recommend to the House that this proposal be not be accommodated for precisely the same reason like the above. We don't want to change the qualification criteria except the age. The fourth one is from APLA MVA. It's about offences committed with a political objective. The commentator stated that whether a crime was committed with a political motive or not is irrelevant in determining whether a person qualifies for a special pension or not. Again, we're saying we recommend to the House that we do not accommodate this, as we again would change the criteria besides the age. And therefore, for us to keep on ensuring that equity, we would like the House to recommend to the House that they don't accept this one. A comment from Azanla, PAC, the ANC veterans from KZN, and the EPPCM. The commentator here stated that there is no basis or justification for backdating pensions payable to the 30 to 35 age group to 1 April 2001. And it was therefore proposed that these pensions be backdated to 1 April 1995, the date from which the 30 to 35 year age group received pensions. Again, Chair, we recommend to the House that these proposals do not be accommodated. The date of April 2001 was informed by the fact that the persons who qualified in December 1996 for the 35-year age group, they qualified for a retrospective year backwards to 1 April 1995. It is important to ensure that the different age groups are treated the same. First one is about disqualification, conviction of a crime after 2 February 1990. Comments from PAC, Azanla, and Azapo. Most of the commentators stated that the existing date of February 2, 1990 does not take account of the fact that not all political organizations suspended their armed struggle on that date. Most commentators propose that the disqualification be deleted. Azapo went further to propose that the existing reference to Schedule 1 crimes be replaced with a reference to Schedule 2 crimes to limit the application of the disqualification to serious offenses. We agree with this and we recommend to the House that the proposal be accommodated and that the disqualification be removed. The qualification does not find application in the pension environment and appears to affect vested rights without adhering to the principles of fair administrative justice. Notable, in respect of the 35 years and older age group, that disqualification lapsed on 31 December 2006 on the lapsing of Part 1 of the Act. Persons, therefore, in this age group that are receiving a pension will therefore not be disqualified. Unfortunately, persons in the said age group whose applications were refused because of the qualification will remain disqualified, as it is not prudent and it would be an administrative nightmare to allow for all new applications from this group because of the reasons alluded to below. This will also create a disparity between the age groups, but is unavoidable and consistent with the negotiations and agreements reached between the parties in 1990. These people that will be disqualified, however, we're saying they will be dealt with on an individual basis. Spouse's pension. Comment from APLA MVA, they propose that surviving spouses should be entitled to 100% of the pension payable to his or her spouse prior to his or her death, and not only 50%. We propose to the House that they do not accommodate this, as it is not in line with current pension practice. What we have now is we pay 50% of the pension payable to a pensioner immediately prior to his or her death within the GEPF. Time frame for application of benefits, that's the next comment. As Zappo stated that the 12-month period with which a spouse or dependent must apply for a spouse's pension is too short and proposed that the period be deleted. We recommend to the House that they accommodate Zappo's request. However, we're saying for a period of 36 months rather than 12 months, and we're not saying delete, we're saying 36 months. Appeal Board, APLA MVA and MK MVA. The commentators propose that non-statutory forces, the Military Veterans Association, should have representation on the appeal board. Now, Chair, the newly constituted appeal board consists of only 3 members. We recommend to the House that this proposal not be accommodated, as an appeal board with more than 3 members will not be effective and efficient. We are, however, saying that appropriate consultation with representatives of the political parties will be ongoing. In fact, if we had our way, we would limit the number of cases that go to the appeal by proper involvement of the political organization. Pensions payable. AFLA MVA, ANC veterans, and AZANLA. The commentators propose that the pension account amounts payable under Schedule 3 should be increased, especially for persons younger than 50 and persons 50 but younger than 65 on 1 December 1996 and currently not yet 65. Chair, the financial implications associated with the amounts reflected in Schedule 3 have been assessed and they are significant, Chair. I think we went through that on Wednesday last week. We consider that the amounts that have been proposed are fair and reasonable, particularly taking into account that the persons in the younger age categories have had a longer opportunity to be economically active since 1990. We must also bear in mind that these amounts are adjusted upwards annually to take care of inflation increases. We therefore recommend to the House that this proposal be not accommodated. General matters, ANC veterans, KwaZulu-Natal and Kulumani. The commentator stated that the closing date for of 31 December 2006 for pension applications for the 35 and older age group should be extended or removed. Now, that closing date, Chair, was informed by policy principles endorsed by Cabinet in July 2005, passed by Parliament in November 2005. And enacted by the President in January 2006. The policy principles were informed by, amongst others, the fact that a period of more than 10 years had elapsed since the promulgation of the Special Pensions Act in 1996. Now, one would think that it would be fair to say that 10 years or more is quite a long time to actually do an application. We were hoping that by then everybody would have been informed that they needed to apply. Quite a number of communication drives were undertaken before this closing date. And we therefore recommend that the House, the committee does not accommodate this principle, this proposal. Qualification for other benefits. ANC veterans, KwaZulu-Natal. The commentator proposed that all benefits payable under the Act should be exempt from tax. A person becomes liable for tax when he or she earns more than 46,000 rand per annum if they are under the age of 65, and when they earn up to 74,000 rand a year if they are over the age of 65. Any benefits other than funeral benefits are actually added to a person's income income, and tax is imposed on the total income of that person. This is consistent with the prevailing tax law in respect of all pensions, and therefore we recommend to the House that this proposal be not accommodated. Permanent and total disability, ANC veterans. The commentator stated that the ill treatment and brutal assaults of certain freedom fighters by certain tribal chiefs who supported apartheid has been overlooked. A number of these fighters were permanently and totally disabled because of this drug treatment. Chair, the Act prior to the lapsing of Part 1 provided that persons who suffered a permanent and total disability arising out of the specific circumstances had a right to a special pension. Perhaps we need to communicate that very clearly. Those people had a right to special pensions. They were considered. MK veterans. The commentators propose that non-statutory force members, Military Veterans Association, should have representation on the appeal board. The Special Pensions Amendment Act 2005 provided for the dissolution of the Special Pensions Board and for its functions to be performed by the National Treasury. As stated above, appropriate consultation and cooperation with political organizations and representative bodies is an integral part of every application and existing process and procedures are being improved to ensure that this indeed takes place. This comment is beyond the scope of the amendment bill. Late application. PAC and AZAPO, the commentator stated that the 6,000 late applications received after 31 December 2006 had been rejected because of the late submission thereof. It is recommended that this proposal be not accommodated, Chair, because subsequent to the enactment of the Special Pensions Amendment Act 2005 that provided for the closing date, the National Treasury embarked on an extensive awareness campaign and urged all former liberation movements as well as relevant military veterans associations to inform their members of the act on the closing date. Again, Chair, I need to stress it had been 10 years since the first act of Special Pensions Act was actually enacted. And it is now becoming a challenge as we are receiving very many fraudulent applications. Annual increases. ANC veterans. The commentator requested the minister to ensure that annual increases of pensions should not be less than 7 to 8%. Chair, I need to report to the House that the average annual increase over the last 3 years was 5% and linked to inflation, and increases granted to GPF pensioners. As in the past, the Minister will take into account current inflation trends in making adjustments going forward. Administration and implementation. ANC Veterans League, ANC Veterans League KZN, and the EPPCM. The commentator stated that the processes and procedures that facilitate the implementation of the Act must be monitored, investigated, and scrutinized. The comments, Chair, are beyond the scope of the amendment bill. However, a number of re-engineering initiatives are in the process of being implemented to improve and ensure the effective and efficient implementation of the Act. Skills training and or other support and compensation to pensioners and others not qualifying. Azanda, ANC Veterans League, KZN, Kulumani, EPPCM. The commentator stated that job guaranteed skill training, medical aid and other support should be provided to pensioners and other pensions that contributed to the struggle but do not qualify for benefits under the Act or the amendment bill. Now, Chair, the purpose of this Act is to provide pensions to persons at pensionable age whose ability to make provision for a pension was impacted by their full-time involvement in the struggle for democracy. The comments are beyond the scope of what we're trying to achieve in the amendment bill. Other, Kulumani. Commentator requested financial support for its activities and that government should withdraw its opposition of its lawsuits against South African corporations. That comment, Chair, we find it to be beyond the scope of the amendment bill. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you. We've had you. Before we go to amendments, can I open this for questions, comments from members? Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair. When we met previously on this bill, there was a request that I made to have a look at the calculation, to see what assumptions were made in calculating how much this was going to cost. I would like to see that, please. And then also, on item number one on this matrix, I agree that the proposal should not be accommodated, but APLA NBA made a very important point when they were at the hearing. They said that there was a group of people who were younger than the group that we're looking at here, who had been excluded from the educational pool because they were ex-combatants and never ever got into the educational process and therefore had difficulty finding jobs, and that is going to obviously impact on them in the longer term. So although it's outside the scope of this bill, there should be some kind of consideration that there is a group like this that does exist, and that maybe there needs to be some kind of intervention at some point. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? If none, can we respond to Dr. George's question? But I would imagine Dr. George agrees that it is outside of the scope of this legislation, and I don't know whether we really can expect a response from the group before us. But I think it's one of the things that we also as a committee should note and perhaps forms part of our recommendations when we report on the bill. Dr. George.
Chair, an answer to question one would be sufficient. Thanks, Chair.
Yes, sir. The question about the calculations and assumptions beyond about the calculations themselves, can we please make that available to you in writing? Because I don't have it with me here, and I don't think you have it either. So could we kindly send that in writing to you with the assumptions?
I think that would suffice, especially because there was also a disparity because between what was in the bill and what was in your presentation. Okay. We'll hold you to that. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. The first one relates to under 35 pension retrospective to April 1, 2001. Recommendation there is that we shouldn't take on board. There in the bill, it talks of instead of having to backdate this 30 to 35 to 201 to 1995, rather, have them to backdate it to 201. Now, the issue for me there is I'm trying to play devil's advocate. You have heard a period for those 35 and above having those applications being open and for 10 years, effectively. Now, you are going to have these 30 to 35 open for effectively 2 years or a year and a half or so. Now, you also shall have had those having applied late within that 10-year period. But would have found themselves having to be backdated to 1995. Imagining here a situation where a person is a late applicant, 206 effectively, and having to be backdated, you know, with such lump sum. Now, that's what is coming through my mind. And as such, therefore, that person is not equally treated with that have applied 1997, would have been 2 years retrospective back day, so to speak. So that's the first one. The second one, Chair, on page 3, convicted of a crime after 2 February 1990. Your response there, third paragraph, rather, notably in respect of 35 and so on. I just couldn't understand this part. Persons in this age group that are receiving pension will therefore not be disqualified. I couldn't, because I was trying to read it together with the paragraph above. maybe you might wish just to clarify that in simple, plain English of a person of my caliber. The last one, Chair, on the Appeals Board, you are recommending here that we do not accept, you know, the incorporation of Military Veterans Association people in your Appeals Board. you have three people already there. I would imagine the point you're raising there is that this would be a bit cumbersome to have more than three people. I would argue against that if I were. But I'm more keen on the rationale, not so much rationale, but let me be very direct. I don't know them. Who are they and how were they appointed? Or rather, what was the rationale to appoint them? Whether are they coming from any of these military veteran associations themselves? Maybe I could also be given an answer to that one. Six is not cumbersome, in my view. Six here would mean military veterans of ANC are flying as APO. In other words, you would be adding three more. But I would be keen to understand the background and the rationale and even the personalities themselves. I don't know them. Thanks.
Okay, are there any other questions? If not, can we then respond to Mr. Johnson's question?
Thank you, Chair. The first one is the retrospective qualification 1 April 2001. I think we need to break it down a bit. Okay. If we're saying the age criterion says you needed to be 35 on the 1st of December 1996, and then if you applied, you got a retrospective payment to April 1995, right? That is, you were now at age 34 or around age 33. Basically, that's the time you qualified or you got the pension for. So you're 35 years, that 1 December 1996, you get a pension for 1996, and you get a pension for 1995. Fast forward, 10 years, 11 years later, we say even if you were 30, you should have qualified. We want to be consistent as to the time that the criterion is applied so that everybody, they get something that is equitable. We don't open a hornet's nest where some people are saying, we only got it from the age of around 34 and these guys are getting it from around the age of 31. Now, if we're saying in 1985, you could have been 19. In 1995, you would have been 29, right? And then in 2001, you would have been around the age of 35, 36. That's the rationale for that retrospective. We're still saying, though you qualify now from the age of 30, we pay you from the time you are around the age of 35. I don't know whether I'm the house is with me.
Yeah, no, I think the arithmetic was simple enough.
It's simple.
It's very simple. I don't know. I don't know.
Okay. Should we do the appeal board question?
You must not underestimate Mr. Johnson's understanding of figures. There is this thing that the statistician general always talks to us about. Isibalo thing. Exactly. Okay, proceed. Because after your responses to Mr. Johnson, seeing that the WIPS have been doing work in order to give us enough manpower to deal, I'm going to request that after your responses, we switch over to the business that would require the manpower that the WIP has brought, so that after it, then we may proceed. But respond to Mr. Johnson's question.
I think just to respond to Honourable Member Johnson's question in respect of the crime issue. In 2005, the amendment lapsed part one, which means that no person could apply for a pension or for a survivor's lump sum benefit. The qualification in respect of losing your pension or not being able to apply for a pension if you were convicted after 1999 of a Schedule 1 crime, then also lapsed with that lapsing of part one. So in 2005, the qualification or the disqualification lapsed. We reintroduced it in the bill for the 30 to 35 category. And when commentators were commenting on that aspect, and we were considering it for possible amendments, we realized that it had already lapsed for that first bet. So we only about Wednesday became aware of the fact that it had lapsed for the 35 and older category. And that's why the proposal from government is being not to have that qualification for the 30 to 35. I think also, as Marion explained, the only unfortunate part of that is that, for instance, people might not have applied or the applications in the 35 to older group would have been rejected because they committed those crimes. And instead of opening it up as a blanket accommodation, we felt it would be appropriate that we deal with persons on an individual basis. So as they bring it to our attention, we can actually accommodate that or settle any claims that may come in respect of individual persons. I don't know, Mr. Johnson, is that sufficient explanation? And because it took us also a while to get to exactly what had happened. Because we lapsed that whole first part. That disqualification also lapsed into respect of 35-year-old and older. But because we wanted to align it, we introduced it for the new group as well. And when we realized that it lapsed for the old part, it was easy for us to concede to accommodate that, that the disqualification be removed.
Chair, would that then mean that also those who shall have found themselves being disqualified also have their disqualifications lapsing? In other words, the question that I'm asking here is, you have somebody who would have found himself, herself, having been affected by that qualification before that lapse. What happened to that person? Because that person found himself as a victim of that clause. If that person wants to appeal, what happened?
Yeah, I respond, Joanne, because what I find you to be saying on page 3 of your matrix is that unfortunately persons in the age group whose applications were refused because of the qualification will remain disqualified, as it is not prudent to allow for new applications from this group because of the reasons alluded to below. But then you go on to say at the end there that these persons will be dealt with on an individual basis. Do you want to respond to Mr. Johnson's question, taking this one into account?
There's approximately 70 people whose pensions were stopped. They were receiving pensions where they committed a crime. There's 70 people whose pensions were stopped in respect of that aspect. All their pensions will be reinstated because they are defined and identifiable groups. So we know who they are. We can easily reinstate it. In respect of people that didn't apply because of that disqualification or whose applications initially were refused, because we don't know who is in that group, we felt that we should have a process in place in the administration that when people come to us and indicate that they fall into that category and if they qualify, that we will accommodate them in respect and settle matters in respect of that. So in a sense, those people will have to institute a claim against government. We have to consider the merits of that and settle it. So the intention is not to reopen the whole group, but only for those persons that indeed approach government in that respect. So there were two specific cases, those who were receiving pensions and who lost it, and in those that were in the application basis. Didn't apply or were refused.
Okay. Are we okay, Mr. Johnson? All right. Is there still a remaining question on the appeal part?
Yes, Chair. Mr. Johnson indicates that 6 is not cumbersome. I'm not sure because an appeal board has got 3 members. I think it's big enough, and an appeal board should not be big anyway because it should be clear the files are prepared. There's a recommendation from the administration side. But anyway, we'll take it forward. I'm not sure who the members of the appeal board are. I think I know one. He's an advocate, Zubeda, somebody. Mm-hmm. What I understand, she's got strong struggle credentials. I don't know whether she's a veteran. She's old enough to be a veteran, but I don't know which political party. But I think if the House needs that information, it will be made available to the House.
Okay. Yeah. I think that deals with the question. Joanne?
Thank you.
But can you then make it available to us? I think in your reports, We do have the names. I'm not too sure, but can we just make it available to us?
I think it's also just important to add that we have quite strong links with political parties and a number of NGOs who assist in terms of the verification processes. And I think it's important for us to further strengthen those links, because the importance is to pull in political parties at the application stage, and not necessarily only when a person already is appealing against a decision of the administration. So we are aware of that, and we currently also have quite a few strong, or have strong links with NGOs and political parties. At the moment we receive an application, it is also referred to all political parties to assist in the verification. So we do have that link, but that's just in addition to Marion's comment that the point is taken that there should be representation. But I also think it's not in, we shouldn't entrench that in legislation, because we find in a number of other instances where we appoint boards to appeal boards, and we're very specific in respect of where those persons need to come from, but we run into difficulties in finding people that can actually fit that profile. And so I think I think the minister will have the insight in respect of who to appoint to ensure that that the political implications and considerations are indeed there.
Okay, can I request then that we suspend the issue of dealing with the amendments, which is quite a short one indeed, so that we can get on to this one, so that we can release the people that otherwise, I know one of the Treasury officials need to be out of the country before very late, so we felt that it would be proper to accommodate them earlier. There had been a request. So you stay with us. But let's allow Jonathan and Momo to come forward for the insurance laws amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for
I can only hear myself. I'm sorry. Without dealing with the insurance laws amendment bill, there is a package that has been circulated to members that has the bill, that has the amendments, but on top is a document which says report back to Portfolio Committee on Finance on Friday the 13th. I trust that that's the document you're going to be talking to first. Okay. What else?
Yes, thank you, Chair, for seeing us, and I should correct you. Now the Treasury official is headed overseas, but the senior official of the FSB will remain unnamed sitting next to me.
That's the problem, I mean. Okay, so you don't want his foot on the other side. That's okay. Go ahead.
Chair, thank you very much. Chair, I think what we thought we would do is then just go through the report back that we have. Just to quickly bring you, just to brief you what's happened since last week, just to go through on page one of that report, I won't go through all of those points, but just to point out that we did inform at Friday's hearing and immediately after to all those who we could reach and those who had submitted comments to the committee or to the Treasury that we'd be sending through the matrix, which we were able to send on Monday morning, and inviting them to a meeting on Tuesday. On Tuesday, Chair, we had quite a phenomenal turnout, which, you know, was, we say here 39, but Kathy, I don't know if they're just 39 of those people who actually put their names on the register, but we were a bit overwhelmed by the response. So we had quite a good meeting. And I'll go through the issues. I think that by and large there was a lot of agreement, except for one point around the process, which I'll come to. Thereafter, we said to those who were present that we take their comments into account after the Tuesday meeting. We then adjusted the bill itself, and we put a track changes version out on Wednesday morning and gave them 24 hours as a yet another opportunity to respond. And we got comments up to yesterday evening on the track version of the bill, indicating how we would change it. And what you have today, I think, is the product of lots of correspondence that we received in writing and which we're happy to make available to you. We have one set here to give to you just for your record. But let me go through them. We've summarized, I think, the issues that were raised at this meeting. And so just to move on to page 2 of this document here, gives you a list of some of the organizations that attended. Others who said they would attend, particularly from the health community, the AIDS Law, I think it's project, I don't know if it's program, and the Department of Health didn't attend because they felt there were no issues for them. In fact, at that meeting, the only issue that, well, let me rather deal with the issues that come through. I don't know if Kathy wants to add just any comments, please feel free to come in. But we also received 9 sets of written comments, which we looked at. I think rather than go through those 3 paragraphs, let me just go through the issues that were raised, and you would be able to see who raised what. I think, Chair, the first issue on the proposed health demarcation, the perspective that we got was now not from the public health perspective, but from the insurance industry. They felt that the product regulation is too onerous for them, that we were focusing too much on the health policy objectives, and they wanted to seek a balance towards also looking at the insurance industry's objectives, I guess, which would mean that they could have health policies out. We pointed out on this call that this was a policy issue, and that government was quite clear about the community rating system, which we wanted to protect. And so we didn't really entertain much discussion on this, but this is a point which, I guess, if I were a representative of the industry, I would have to say no matter what. The other concern that certainly came out was just that the transitional arrangements were unclear. And we'll deal with that under point 4, which sort of people wanted to know what would happen if our bill, the health provisions take effect and the amendments to the Medical Schemes Act take effect at a different time. So we'll deal with the issue of coordination later. That's just for us an administrative issue once the bill is passed. I won't go through the specific points. I think that we've got a formal response that to the health issues. We specifically, it is acknowledged that the court ruling obtained in the short-term sector cannot be seen to provide certainty against the backdrop of an evolving health policy space. I think this is just what we pointed out, that there was more uncertainty in this particular case, and that we feel that we pointed out that we were actually expanding the scope for the insurance industry, and we didn't believe that the process to demarcate the products would introduce more uncertainty. It was actually providing much more opportunity for them, but within the framework of government's broader health objectives. We did point out that when we do the regulations, we will consult the industry quite extensively, so that the whole issue of the regulations that the minister will issuing consultation with the Minister of Health will certainly be one where the industry and, of course, the health sector and both private and public will be consulted. I think I pointed out the Department of Health didn't feel it was necessary to attend, largely because they felt that the issues had been dealt with. Council of Medical Schemes was there, but they didn't feel that it was even necessary to talk. I think with regards to the binder agreements, I'm going to ask Jonathan to deal with the specific issues under 2NC, because the issues that came up, certainly under binder agreements, before he comes on, let me say that I was quite struck at how the industry was broadly happy with the approach. They felt that the points had been taken into account, and aside from some of the process issues around consultation, I was struck by the fact that there were no objections. People felt that we had certainly heard them and were kind of quite happy with the approach broadly. Similarly, I think the third set of issues, which again was not raised in a very strong way, that those around auditing, reporting, and valuation. I think aside from raising a new issue about how I think there were two issues. How the statement of intent, the approach that we've taken would impact on this bill. And somebody had also raised an issue of FIFE legislation and how, or some of the changes that we've made, how that impacts on this bill. But I think those are the general issues which perhaps Jonathan can talk about. I'll deal with the last issue, which was, I think, certainly the one point which I can't say everybody agrees, but I would say that there is a fundamental disagreement also. But do you want to just deal with the binder and the... if Baron or Kathy or Joanne want to add on, please to add on.
What seems to be the problem? Is Baron supposed to be sitting closer? Yeah, at least if they could take the front desk there so that they are. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Dick.
Thank you, Chair. Hopefully this is working?
Yeah,
thanks. Thanks, Chair. As Momo's pointed out, on the binder agreements, we seem to have found our way through. In the workshop, there were comments in support of the approach that was proposed, which is basically to deal with some of the particular concerns around some of the details of various aspects of binder agreements through regulation. As we mentioned last time, I think the sort of residual concerns around dealing with it through regulations was whether it would provide sufficient opportunity for consultation. So, as mentioned last time, we've proposed provisions that commit to timeous and thorough consultation with stakeholders in determining the regulations. So there was broad support with that. Some stakeholders did raise a few technical issues. They raised the issue that we mentioned to the committee last time, that there are interlinkages between these proposals and the broader policy issues around looking at defining the intermediary relationship or the relationship between the client and the intermediary. And we've certainly noted those and recognized that those two processes, in other words, drafting these regulations and examining the intermediary relationship issues, will run in parallel. I'll just run through some of the other issues. There was relatedly a request that independent intermediary be defined. Some wording clarification on some of the subsections was noted. Clarity was requested regarding who could be paid for what services. It was also noted the potential overlap for underwriting managers between the Insurance Act provisions and FICE. There was a question around the wording of sub 4, which implies the contravention will be against the written agreement rather than the contravention itself. So all of the comments were, I guess, quite sort of technical and really around the wording. And lastly, concerns were expressed around the transitional arrangement. So if I can just go through the response that is put forward in the ABIL. As indicated, the broader policy concerns around the regulatory treatment of binder agreements has been resolved. And in basically, if an insurer has an outsourcing arrangement that either creates or varies a liability for the insurer, then it must be in terms of a written agreement. The ultimate liability remains with the insurer, and the insurer retains ownership of the policy information. I think everyone's agreed on that. And in a sense, they're making certain common law provisions explicit in the insurance legislation. What we also, as mentioned last time, we also recognize that there are various forms of binder agreements in practice that must be accommodated, and there's also interrelationships between these issues and the broader policy reform of intermediary structures. That's recognized, and we've committed to look at the issues in parallel. In terms of wording, it was recognized that the wording around sections 49 and 49A and 48 and 48A respectively required some clarification, and we have in the ABLE proposed some wording which we certainly think helps clarify that. As mentioned last Friday, there are two real policy issues, if you like, or substantive concerns that were raised were firstly around the degree to which profit sharing could be allowed, and secondly the circumstances under which a party to a binder agreement can deal directly with the public. It was agreed in the workshop that these classifications could be determined through regulation, really because they, you know, the details of those kind of arrangements are probably more suitable to regulation rather than being in the Act. But dependent on it following a legislative consultation period and requiring that proposed regulations be tabled to Parliament and placed in the public domain. And I think once there was that comfort, I think we went a long way. Just a few of the other technical issues. The debate around defining independent intermediary is really a broader one that needs to take place within the broader intermediary commission policy process that I've mentioned is currently underway, and it's not attempted in this Act or this bill to address that. The issue around the wording of Section 4, we have recommended that the wording stays as is, because really what it says is that the written agreement must place certain obligations on the binder party, and if those are not met, it holds the insurer liable for the actions of the binder party as intended. We are firmly placing the ownership of the policy information, but also the liability in terms of the policy, firmly with the insurer and with the insurance company. It is around clarifying those responsibility issues. We also agreed that there are issues of potential overlaps between the FICE and the Insurance Act, but those are beyond the scope of this Act and will be handled in consultation with the FICE division. And then lastly, regarding the transitional arrangement, it was agreed that the relevant binder sections the proposal put forward would be that the relevant binder sections will be implemented only once the regulations are finalized. So to allay people's concerns that there's any sudden impact on existing arrangements. So that covers binder agreements. Just quickly on a few of the other technical issues, the auditing reporting, as we mentioned last week, the comments were really around that the reporting obligations for auditors were too onerous. Our response remains the same as last week, that any contravention of insurance legislation is a contravention that causes concern, and that the auditor is seen as an extension of the supervisor, so the proposed amendment is retained in the ABLE. With regarding the reporting obligations for the statutory actuaries, two issues there, again, that the reporting is too onerous, and secondly, that the statutory actuary should not be subject to criminal liability in terms of the bill. As our response, as with last week, was that we agree that the intention was not to make the statutory actuary into a compliance officer, so we have restricted the reporting obligations to areas that around the financial conditions of the insurer. However, we do think that the statutory actuary, in performing his or her obligation, should be held liable for his or contraventions of the Act. So we are proposing to retain the provisions that the statutory actuary can be held criminally liable in certain circumstances. There was an issue around reasonable value of assets. If fair value of assets wasn't resulting in a reasonable value for statutory purposes, we again clarify that that revaluation is only for statutory purposes, for the purposes of establishing solvency buffers, not for financial reporting circumstances, and in any case it would not be interpreted to apply retrospectively. The next issue, that is a new provision in response to comments that the Treasury and FSB agree with, the comment that there should be an enabling provision in the legislation to ensure that the regulations introduced last year to give effect to the statement of intent signed in December 2005 are properly empowered through legislation. Certainly we see the risk of challenge to those regulations are small, but we also agree that that the proposed amendment will give further backing to the statement of intent commitments, which basically state that where policyholders who've got retirement annuities or endowment policies, where they've received very poor termination values on those policies in the past, the insurers were required through the regulations to go back and top up, improve those values for those customers, and to backdate those improvements. So the proposed amendment will give further strength, further legislative backing to those requirements. And then lastly, the issues on criminalisation through Section 66 and 67 in the Long Term Act and 64 and 65 in the Short Term Act. Those sections have been reverted to the wording of the Principal Act. It was agreed that what is not required, that a blanket provision making any contravention a criminal offence was not required, and what is in place in the ABLE is identifying which specific sections or where a contravention of which specific sections will amount to a possible criminal offence. Everything else, of course, subject to the approval of the General Financial Services Laws Amendment Bill, will be subject to the Enforcement Committee that is proposed in that bill. What has been added is that any contravention of the requirements with respect to binder agreements in Sections 48A and 49A respectively, and any contravention of the statutory actuary's duties were added to the list of where a criminal offence is possible.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, then I think the last issue that certainly emerged was that many in the industry at various points would raise objections about the insufficient time granted for consultation and for the bill to be approved. I should add that, you know, many of the people who attended certainly are not very au fait with parliamentary processes kind of almost anticipate that even in the period after the public hearings to when the bill is approved by the committee requires almost like another huge consultative process. I think we felt quite clearly that the you know, we accept that the consultation period was short, but we don't think that, as some would suggest, it's unconstitutional. I think that's been rather dramatic. And secondly, I think to the extent that there were issues, I think that we've had quite an exhaustive process at all times in consulting with the industry. You will see from some comments they would say, but 24 hours is too little, we don't have time to consult. But that was this week. They came to the meeting on Tuesday. We said, look, the version you have is the one we gave out on Friday and put on the web on Monday. So comment against that version. And in giving them a further 24 hours, I think it was just to say the people who are present, who are actually looking at the legislation, can, you know, can they just give us their feeling? We accept they're not going to be able to consult with every player in the insurance industry. And we kind of pointed out that it was the nature really of all legislation, that at some point we've got to make a call. And so I think that we do feel that we've gone out of our way, I think, to take into account the points made. And I should add that the points have significant, less to significant amendments as to the bill itself. I think with regard to the last point on consultation of the regulations, we've pointed out that we will have, we will have draft regulations. We will have at least 50 days of consultations even before we come and table the draft regulations in Parliament. That they would have ample opportunity to comment. And I should add that a lot of the regulations will only work if we in fact have a good consultation process with the industry. So we certainly, it's in our interest, I think, certainly as a department and FSB to do that. We also pointed out that even on the transitional mechanism, Clause 57 of the bill has a standard provision that once the President signs the bill into an act, the Minister will still gazette the date of implementation for various provisions, and that this will ensure that, for example, we would certainly consult with the industry even around the dates for implementation of various sections, for example, around the binder agreements. I think that's going to be necessary. And certainly with the health sector, we also, aside from consultation, ensure that we coordinate with the Department of Health that the provisions or the amendments they make on the definition of business for medical scheme or any other amendments in the medical schemes act which affect us, that these are kind of coordinate it and hopefully take it back on the same day if that's possible. So, Chair, I think without much further ado, those were the major issues. We've tried to bring all the material issues to your attention. We will leave you with a copy of every comment that we've received, but we thought it would be a bit bulky to circulate. But we do have, we will give it to you for your record, so you can circulate it when you like to other members, if that's your decision. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, that's the report. Members, are there any questions on this report relating to matters that have been raised and the issue of consultation, the binder on the binder agreement, and the demarcation? Questions, Dr. George?
Thank you, Chair. On the health demarcation, the compelling argument that was brought to the committee was that the issue of cost subsidization. If you've got a medical scheme, you don't want to create an environment where you are taking out the young, the wealthy, and the healthy, so it would be anti-selection against the scheme. That concept is fully understood and obviously agreed with. But at the same time, then, you need to look at it with two pools. There's one pool and another pool. In the one pool, you've got the medical scheme where you want, say, for example, individual A to be in the pool to cross-subsidize with other people. And then you have pool B, which may well be an insurance pool. Now, if the person already is in pool A and providing cross-subsidization in that pool, so that would tick the box, that would be fine, there is no reason why they cannot then also be in another pool B of their choice of an insurance product. Now, the point I'm just trying to make is that concept understood effectively? Because it is, once a person is in a pool and cost subsidizing, then the deed is done. There is no reason why then you would stop an insurance company from designing some kind of innovative product right from the outset. So that's the one, the first point. And then on the public consultation process, I think it's been said before, is that it would be a good idea to have ongoing dialogue with various people in the industry or bodies in the industry so that, you know, the conversation is continuing and going forward, and then you will probably be closer from the outset. But the question that would come to mind now in this particular process is, if the consultation process carried on going, will the output here change? And having looked at the outputs you've provided today, the answer is probably no. And therefore, my view certainly is that the consultation process has been effective in this instance. Thanks, Chair.
Other questions? If none, can I take a response? Is there a question? I see Mr. Tavis, the glasses lifting. Is it your glasses lifting? Oh, okay. No, question first.
Chairperson, my question really relates to our total expenditure on health as a country, not in terms so much of the GDP, but the total fiscal. I think in terms of the Abuja Declaration, we're supposed to spend 15% of the total budget on health-related matters. And while one agrees that this is not necessarily the cure, but to what extent would this take us progressively perhaps to that percentage point, because it is a matter of concern, whilst indeed the total social wage of our country is not even comparable to that of many developing countries or even countries in Africa. One perhaps would like to hear the opinion of the presenters on my question, on the question. Thank you.
Yeah, if National Treasury and the FSB are not ready for that question, I wouldn't blame you. We'll pardon you. But go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I think with regard to the first question, Dr. George, I think we should point out that we will deal with the issues through through regulations. But having said that, you know, it is, I mean, I understand the fears of the health community in the sense that, you know, people could, even if they're in poor A, they could have very low-level medical cover and kind of shift their focus towards the insurance product. Of course, there are prescribed minimum medical benefits that will apply. So it is a challenge to make sure that you get the balance right. At the same time, I mean, we are creating a space for the insurance industry because there are genuine products that would that are important to have, whether they be accident or health cover or other contingencies just related to health. So, getting the balance right is important, and I think certainly the consultation process around the regulations, I think, is going to be an important one, and the regulations that we have, I think, will hopefully bring the kind of certainty that the industry and everybody else would like, and deal with the fears that there are in the health community. With regard to the second question, Chair, I should just add that you'll find declarations that say 15% on health, 10% on agriculture, and you then wonder why even have a government if everything is just automatic percentage spending. I should say that I think that the budget is determined in terms of priorities that government has, not in terms of artificial percentages that have been set. And for example, if you take the agriculture provision in a highly urbanized economy like South Africa, what the appropriate percentage would be would differ from country to country. And I think we come to you on Wednesday with the input on some of the growth papers. And I think one of the key issues that we focus that you need to see country specific, one need to look at local priorities, as I pointed out. I think the other point to take note of is I think now perhaps I've been too long in government. I think in 1994, many of us used to feel all we need to do is to put money in a sector and all the problems would be solved. I think now we have less hair, we've gotten grayer, and we found that is it really going to happen that if we put more money in a sector, it's going to be more efficient? And I think the challenge certainly for us in the public health sector is a great one, that whatever the sector, but certainly in the public health sector, that we get it functioning more effectively and efficiently. Certainly that will do much more to ensure that people shift towards using public health resources rather than being forced to go to the private sector. But that's a challenge that remains here. Do you want to add to this?
Chair, if I can also just add a little bit to the Honourable Member George's question. I think it's quite hard to respond to the question without getting into the policy debate. But, you know, Dr. George's comments really do, I think, focus on what is the key question, because as we said, the principle is that these regulated insurance products should not undermine medical schemes, and you could probably add to that they should not undermine appropriate levels of cover through medical schemes. So really the policy question is, at what sort of level should those prescribed minimum benefits be set so that you have comfort that all members have an appropriate level of cover through medical schemes, set the parameters of that pool, and then, as has been said, once you're comfortable with that, that's an appropriate level, anything over and above that, I think is open to be provided through individual risk rate products. And that is something that the Council's medical schemes and our discussions with them has also not disagreed with. So it's really about a discussion around where that appropriate level is and what type of insurance products may or may not undermine those principles. So, but I think, you know, what the provisions in the bill are really saying is they're providing for a process to have those policy discussions jointly with the Department of Health in consultation with the well, after consultation with the Council for Medical Schemes and the FSB. So I think we've gone a long way in saying we're going to have a joint process to finally arrive at some answers to these questions. And then when we come back with regulations, when we come back to this committee, I think it would be also appropriate for the, you know, for a presentation on the policy thinking that went behind behind those regulations.
Okay. Amendment.
I ask Joanne, our eminent legal eagle, I don't know if Kathy or Alan wants to come over. We'll sit at the back.
Will Ms. Ferreira please come to the front? Clause by clause.
Just to highlight, when we were discussing the General Financial Services Laws Amendment Bill, we indicated that because it's quite difficult to follow from the ABLE to the Bill as Tabled to the Principal Act, the whole things fit together, we prepared a track changes version of the bill as well, of the bill that was tabled. So all the amendments that we are proposing or putting in front of the committee in respect of the ABLE has been done in track changes on the bill as tabled. And I think everybody should have a colour copy which quite clearly indicates
the intent. You're referring to the photocopied bill that has got the red, red inserted and underlined. Okay. Have all members got that version of the bill? Go ahead, Joanne.
If I can then go into clause one of it's a document titled Portfolio Committee Amendments to the Insurance Laws Amendment Bill, which is the amendment we would like to propose to the committee for consideration. If we go to clause one, on page three of the tables bill, in line 70, to omit an asset. Mr. Chief President, can I just ask, should I talk through all of the provisions, highlight each one, or can I indicate whether it's merely a technical amendment or a correction or editorial?
Because we've actually had quite some time on some of the stuff. The latter will do.
If we can deal with amendments 1 to 5 under clause 1, all of them are editorial. Most of them are due to the insertion of a new definition for medical schemes just to facilitate referencing. They include amendment 6 on page 4 and 9.18 is then the insertion of the definition of medical scheme purely for referencing purposes. Over the page on page 2.
But shouldn't you have first referred us to the objects of the bill? Because, is it at the back? Are you talking to it at the end?
It's the last provision in the amendment bill. According to the state law advisors, that's the correct process and procedure format in which it should be. So it's on page 33 of the amendment document, that's the last one.
Okay, so it's fine then, proceed.
So we're on page 2, amendment 8 at the top, just also proposes a referencing provision to insert the definition of wide health company, because we refer to that quite a number of times in the bill. If we're on clause 2, on page 4 in line 41, it's also just a reference which need not be there as there is a definition of Financial Services Board in the Principal Act. Clause 3 on page 4 in line 48, to insert all persons, just to make it clear that in respect of directives can be issued generally or to specific persons. On page 4 in line 50, to omit the reference to subsection 1 and to substitute with subparagraph A. This is a technical correction. On page 5 in line 5, to omit cancel. The next one to omit previously, both of them are just purely semantic issues. The last amendment on clause 3, on page 5 in line 15, to omit paragraph C. That omission is due to the agreement in respect of the whole demarcation issues, which removed the need for the two registrars to engage in respect of certain products. Everything is now included in the regulation. Clause 4, on page 5 in line 29, to make the reference to the Medical Schemes Act, to the citation bit, as we inserted the definition. On page 3 of the amendment, the proposed ABLE, we are proposing an amendment on page 5 of the table built in line 38 to omit undertaken to substitute conduct. That's also a technical amendment. On clause 6, amendment, mostly all of the amendments in respect of clause 6 are basically improvements, mostly suggested by the industry and in an attempt to at least use the wording that are more appropriate in the context. We made quite a number of amendments. We must also get to omit words like from time to time, to appoint, to insert by it, Wiser Health Company to replace it, Wiser Health Company to ensure consistency. So most of the amendments are from the first amendment up to amendment 21 on page 5 are all merely technical amendments that does not affect substantive issues. We then on clause 7 on page 5, which means page 6 on the table bill from line 53, to omit paragraph B, Roman 1, and to substitute it with a new paragraph. Most of the amendments here are just to clarify the circumstances in respect of which the statutory actuary must submit reports through to the registrar, and the amendment that we proposed were to ensure that when the statutory actuary picks up on an issue, that it must first report to the board of directors of the company, and only where there is a material contravention or non-compliance, also report that to the registrar. That is consistent with how the approach is reflected in the bill in respect of how the auditor reports through, so we just provide for consistency there. On clause 8, which is on page 6 of the proposed ABLE, to amend on page 7 in line 34 of the table bill, just also a technical correction, the second one also just that the word composition appears more appropriate than the word constitution, and that relates to the audit committee. So instead of how it's constituted, it's how it's composed. Clause 11, the first amendment on clause 11, which is page 8 of in line 54 of the table version, just a deletion of unnecessary words. On page 8 in line 56, to omit deemed to have failed and to substitute fail or was likely to fail. You'll see all the amendments on that, the rest of clause 11, are basically just also technical corrections to make it read more appropriately. In the, if one looks at the principal act, clause 1 requires a sound financial position. Clause 2 indicates when you are deemed to are sound or not sound. And in 3, which is this which is clause 11 of ARBL, just indicates as to what the consequences are or when you may declare a dividend or not, declare or pay a dividend or not. So it's just trying to ensure that the wording read appropriately in the context of subsection 1 and 2 of the Principal Act. On clause 13, on page 9 from line 40, to omit proper value, the registrar may direct the long-term insurer to. What we are trying, the provision initially indicated if a proper value is not given to an asset, the registrar may request the insurer to appoint another person to reassess the value of an asset. However, we've changed that to allow the registrar to appoint a person at the cost of the insurer to do a reassessment. And that was necessary as the insurer could just appoint another person that might not be appropriate or have sufficient expertise and experience according to the registrar. So we've changed that around and made the registrar, or given the registrar the ability to appoint a person to do the assessment at the cost of the insurer. The amendment 2 and 3 on clause 13 are all the technical ones to improve the wording, and to just align with the amendment we proposed in 1 on clause 13. Over the page, on clause 14, On page 10, in line 1 of the table's version, to omit the current paragraph C and to replace it with a new paragraph, it's basically just to clarify or split out the instances or the reasons that the reasons for which an insurer may invest in derivatives, and to clarify what the obligations would be. They can, you'll see there's also an A and a B, which is part of the principal act, but we're also saying that they may invest in derivatives for purposes of efficient portfolio management and also to reduce investment risk. However, if they make those investments, they must ensure that there are sufficient assets to back it up. And in respect of derivatives for reducing investment risk, which might be high risk in any case, the statutory actuary has in writing to agree to those investments, and that's purely to protect the financial position. On clause 15, the two amendments there are also, you'll see we're just moving the phrase by a specific date or within a specific period just to the beginning of the section. Clause 17, that relates to the issues that Jonathan highlighted earlier in respect of commissions and enumeration issues in respect of binder agreements. In respect of deferring the matters to regulation, it was necessary to remove the words other than enumeration referred to in section 49A on page 10 in line 46 of the table 4. On clause 18, which is the binder agreement provision in respect of the Long Term Insurance Act, you'll see that most of the provisions we've just replaced completely to ensure that that all the amendments that were proposed and deemed appropriate are reflected. On page 11, in line 5, we've omitted the whole of section 1 and replaced it with a new section. And the amendments are basically what we've added in is to say there may be regulations made in respect of those issues and to clarify that the binder agreement is entered into in respect of certain actions which are performed on behalf of an insurer. And then in terms of A to E, we've just deleted the reference back to A again. And I think that's why that's where the track changes version becomes quite helpful, because although it looks like we've replaced quite a substantive section, if one looks at the track changes version, we can see that it's actually a small amount of changes, but just a lot. So no substantive, but a lot of technical amendments. So that's why we've replaced it. The same applies to page 11 after line 80. We've inserted a new A, purely to clarify the current A and splitting the current paragraph A provision in two by just providing that an agreement must first set out which activities may be performed and then also the particular kind of long-term policies in respect of those activities may perform. So A remains in place, but we've just further amplified it in respect of the new A. All the amendments in respect of 3 to 6 relates back to the changes we've effected in Amendment 1 on that page by omitting the word charged with determined and also to remove the words all pay from claims, that where claims are determined all paid, because all paid is seen as purely an administrative issue and not a binder issue. We then over the page on page 10 of the proposed ABLE, on Amendment number 8 on that page, just an insertion to make to ensure that regulations may be effective in respect of those matters, also consistent with how Jonathan presented the binder agreement provision. On Amendment 9 on page 12 from line 9, to omit subsections 3 and to substitute it with the following section. It's also a provision that was there. However, we've extended, we've included the ability to allow for additions of amounts to gross premiums. Previously, it only referred to claims and profits, but we've also included premiums, amounts that may be deducted from premiums or added to premiums. And that is also to make sure or ensure that requirements, limitations, and prohibitions may be prescribed by regulation in that regard. Amendment 10 on page 10, to amend page 12 from line 16 of the bill as table, to omit the current subsection 4 and to substitute it with another provision. It was also merely to clarify the provision as was inserted in the table for to ensure that a long-term insurer or that a binded party can only render services in respect of specific services. And to prohibit certain services, or to prohibit the rendering of the services in respect of policies other than those specifically identified in the agreement. On page 11 of the proposed ABLE, on page 12 from line 36, to amend the Principal Act, to omit the current paragraph C and to substitute, there were a number of comments in respect of how we initially phrased the provision that ensures that information on policies must revert back to the insurer on termination of the binder agreement. So we have purely technical amendments affected to better reflect the intention. If we, on clause 19, all the amendments proposed in respect of clause 19, which runs over on page 12, is a total of 11 amendments, and all of the amendments included in that provision was to ensure that a policyholder can demand that a policy benefit be paid in cash. And specifically in the context of assistance business where a service and or cash could be paid. And we have amended the provision or the current situation in the table bill to provide for either party to demand that it can be paid in cash. And I think in light of the comments, we've changed that it's only the policyholder can insist on the policy benefit to being rendered in cash and not the the insurer. We then, on page 12, we're also proposing the insertion of a new clause. And the new clause will amend section 54 of the Principal Act. The only amendment affected to that clause is in subsection 2, which requires which allows for the requirements and limitations that may be set out in regulation to apply to policies irrespective of the date in terms of which it was entered into. So if we issue a regulation in 2006, it will also apply to a policy that that was entered into in 2000, for instance. That was also to clarify the issues that Jonathan raised in respect of the statement of intent to ensure that there's no legal challenge on those aspects. Then on page 13 from clause 20, clause 20 and clause 21, the amendments there is basically reverting back to the wording in the Principal Act as they are, and nearly to the only changes are to insert references to binder agreements on clause 20, and to insert a reference to the statutory actuary, so when he or she does not comply with their obligation to report, and clause 21 is exactly the same. So the provisions you see there are basically what's currently in the Act. However, we've just inserted criminal offences in respect of binder agreements and the statutory actuary. Jonathan also highlighted or elaborated on the reason for that amendment. On clause 22, technical amendments needed to align with the new definition that we inserted in respect to the referencing. Then clause 23, we proposed that the clause be rejected and then replaced with a new clause. Basically, we're rejecting clause 72, the amendments to 72 as it's reflected in the tabled version, purely because there were such a number of amendments there. And all the amendments, this is the regulation section, and the amendments they relate first of all to the binder agreement. So if you look at paragraph A, we'll set out all the matters that may be described in terms of binder agreements. Over the page on page 16, paragraph B allows for differentiation in respect of binder of those agreements, but that provision will also apply to the full regulation provision in the Act. And on paragraph C, which relates to the health demarcation issues, which is inconsistent with what we presented and agreed to by health and Council for Medical Schemes. Then over the page on page 17 at the bottom, there's a new 2B to be inserted, and that is to provide for the regulations to be published for comment and also tabled in Parliament prior to the promulgation thereof, which is also consistent with what Moa presented earlier. And then on page 18, on clause 27, the amendments 1 to 6 well, that's basically all of them. Once you carry over the page on 19 are all technical amendments, merely to correct referencing, to insert a definition of medical schemes act for reference purposes, and then also a definition of wild health company for referencing purposes further in the act. On page 19 of the ABLE, clause 28, it's also purely a referencing or removing the reference to the Financial Services Board, as there is a definition included in the act, so the reference were irrelevant or unnecessary. On clause 29, all the amendments are also technical, except for the first amendment, which is just, again, to clarify that the directive can be generally or in respect of a person. And we're now into, basically, from clause 27 is where the short amendments to the Short-Term Insurance Act start. So you'll see a lot of them appear to be exactly the same as the amendments under the Long-Term Insurance Act, because the two acts are aligned. And then on clause 29, the only other amendment is, or significant amendment is amendment 6, which omits paragraph C, and that was also the reference, the previous reference in the table for the registrar of insurance and then the Council for Medical Schemes to agree on the exclusion of certain policies, but that has been removed in accordance with the agreement. Clause 30 is a technical amendment to correct referencing more and insert more appropriate wording. On page 20, clause 23, clause 32, thanks. All of those amendments, if one goes from 1 to 20, are all technical amendments purely to better reflect the intention. There's no substantive provision in that. It's purely wording changes throughout. Then on page 22 and clause 23, we'll see if we have discussed this under the long term. It's on page 19 from line 58 in the table version to omit paragraph B, Roman 1, and to substitute. And it relates to the statutory action. Again, it was the only substantive amendment there is to clarify the circumstances and the situation under which the statutory auditor must statutory actuary must report to the board of directors and the registrar. Over the page on page 23, the amendment number 3, which amends page 20 from line 42 of the tabled version, to omit the currency and to insert that provision purely to clarify when the statutory actuary may speak at meetings, which meetings may attend, and at which meetings may indeed provide an input. And that was also a comment from industry to say that the meetings or the extent of the actuary's participation in meetings are limited to duties assigned to him in terms of the act. Or by any law or code of practice and not have it as a general provision that he can attend all meetings. Then we're on to clause 36. Both amendments here are quite technical, just to omit an and to replace with the and also use more appropriate wording instead of constitution composition. Clause 39, the first amendment is on page 22 and line 27 to amend, to reject the amendment there and then to replace it with what follows from 2 to from 2 to 5, so basically clarifying wording. That's a similar provision or amendment similar to what we discussed under the Long-Term Insurance Act, as to say when dividends may be declared or not. So it's all technical amendments. On clause 41, that is also a similar amendment to what we discussed in the long term, to allow the registrar to appoint a person to do a re-evaluation of an asset instead of just directing the insurer to appoint another person. On clause 43, that's the clause, the commensurate clause on the long term in respect of derivatives, to clarify when derivatives may be invested in. And it was also just a clarification in terms of when efficient portfolio management may be one of the reasons for which it may invest in derivatives. And you'll see from 1 and 2 that we just moved the relevant provision upwards. On clause 44, on page 25 of the proposed ABLE, On clause 44, both those amendments are just moving the word by a specific date within a specific period from lower down in the section to the preamble to the provision. Clause 45, on page 24 of the tables bill, in line 22 and in line 27, to give effect to how the enumeration commissions will be dealt with in future in respect of binder agreements, so those references had to be corrected. Clause 45 is in the binder agreement in respect of long-term insurance, and all the amendments proposed in respect of this section, which is from 1 to 15 on page 28, are exactly the same as which we proposed for the Long-Term Insurance Act. The only difference is that in respect of a reference to the insurer, there's also a Lloyd's underwriter specific included in respect of short-term insurance. We're then on page 28, clause 49, which is again to the offences section, clause 49 and clause 50. Both of those amendments, or the ABLE proposes to reverse back to the wording in the Principal Act and only to insert additional offences in respect of the statutory, actuary and non-compliance with binder agreements. Clause 51 is just a referencing provision. 52 is the regulation provision, which similarly to we did under long-term, to reject the current clause and to replace it with a new clause, basically replacing 70 of the Short-Term Insurance Act. The first part then deals with binder agreement regulation, the different types of or differentiation that we made, and then the medical schemes one. All of those are exactly the same as which we proposed under the Long-Term Insurance Act. And then we're on page 33, which is in the amendment to the long title, just a few references there. And it's basically in respect of the amendments that we are proposing in respect of the ABLE to also reflect in the long title where those amendments should be made.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members now regarding those proposed amendments? No questions. I see people are just leaving the house. Are they? No. When you're upstairs, you stay right there. You're upstairs. People don't leave the house when they're upstairs. I trust that people are just taking a quick comfort break before we break for tea. But I would want them to come to return so that we can conclude this part. Especially in the light of the fact that there are no questions. Because the longer we delay this part, questions might spring into mind. can members continue behaving themselves until these people come back? Those guys have nothing to do with us. What did you do with Mr. Dichavit? Did you kill him outside? members could just bear with us, because we will be breaking for tea just now and then come back and finalize also the special pension. We're just trying to ensure that whatever people might have wandered to, they must return. Perhaps whilst we are still waiting for people, why don't we quickly deal with the short amendment to the special pension, because it's the same face and the same body and the same Joanne, you want to take us quickly? There was a page that had the proposed amendment to the special pension, which was subsequent to the matrix that we read in the submission. Do you want to quickly take us through that? Because that does not require the numbers that I'm waiting for. Go ahead. Have members got that that page? It's just a pager. Joanne, I think we must go back to the other one. Because some of the numbers that we are working on are on a very short lease. Okay, having then listened to the amendments on the insurance laws amendment bill, I would now like to read the motion of desirability. I need to breathe in heavily. The motion of desirability is as follows: that in the opinion of the committee, legislation is desirable to amend as per the long title. Agreed. And then the report reads as follows. The Portfolio Committee on Finance, having considered and examined the Insurance Laws Amendment Bill, Bill 26 of 2008, National Assembly, Section 75, referred to it and classified by the Joint Tagging Mechanism as a Section 75 bill, reports the bill with amendments. Agreed. Thank you. Thanks, honorable members, and thanks to those members that have had to give up some of their other responsibilities to be with us. Your contribution is highly valued. Thank you very much. Okay, we then have finalized the Insurance Laws Amendment Bill. Thanks to all the people that worked day and night. I know it has not been very easy. And I would imagine also the process of consultation as having been agreed to, and the culture of continuing to engage with the stakeholders on some of the issues, and right up to the time we look at the regulations and beyond, that continues, because it is the cornerstone of our democracy, and it assists us in having legislation that enjoys the support of everyone, including the people that are being regulated. Thank you very much once again, National Treasury, FSB, honorable members. We then move on to the next one. Joy, special pension. The amendment. Just that brief. Thank you.
As Marion indicated, going through the matrix, there's two amendments that we wish to place in front of the committee. The first one, which is on clause 2, amendments 1 to 3, proposes the removal of the disqualification and qualification that persons in the 30 to 35 category will be disqualified from applying or receiving a pension should they commit a crime listed in Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 of the Criminal Procedure Act. And the amendment is affected by on page 3 in lines 48 of the table bill to remove subsections 6 and 7, and then just to correct the numbering in respect of the remaining subsections of the provision. The second amendment we would like to propose is on page 6 from line 3 of the table bill to omit paragraph B and to substitute it with a new provision. And what we are changing is the period of 12 months to 36 months. The effect of the amendment would be to allow spouses and orphans that are entitled to benefits on the death of pensioners to apply within a period of 3 years as opposed to previously a period of 12 years.
As opposed to 12 months, not 12 years, sorry. I know Friday this time, anything is possible. Okay, that then brings us to the end of that session as well, if there are no questions, because we will only be formally considering the special pensions on the 17th, that's Tuesday next week, yeah. Once again, thank you very much to everybody that has